it seems to me, perhaps you're suggesting with the companies doing research in Mexico that that is not part of the forest bias phenomenon, but in fact, it's kind of this covert attempt to supposedly promote a forest bias approach to understanding genomic diversity. But yet, in fact, it's just fueling some corporate, corporate interests.
I think that that articulates it well. I think for the actors involved, I think, you know, the tensions that I'm pointing out, that, that sort of they can live with it. You know, last night I attended a pharmaceutical pitch, and they're very clear, you know, yes, this is meant to help people, but we also have, we have our public also are our shareholder, are the people who are investing, and we have to you know, produce for them too. And so it's held in, you know, in tension, but all of these sort of motivations and interests coexist. And I don't think, you know, in practice that choosing any kind of pure way is necessarily what I'm promoting, or that's they, it's even possible. But I think you say it well.
Mm-hmm. I think the Mexican little attempt to sort of alter genetic patrimony, probably not out of the blue, it's probably reacting to the Icelandic scandal, which the whole nation actually was, the genetic pattern was investigated by an American pharmaceutical company.
Decode.
Yeah.
I definitely think you know, that was around the same time. But I think even the, a longer history, if you look at the way that the laws that exist for protecting other natural resources in Mexico are often geared towards the U.S. sort of bio-colonial. That's how it's sort of seen, a larger bio-colonial threat, right? And so you can see precedents even before Decode and Me, where Mexico and Mexican researchers and different industries are sort of trying to protect their resources, so that DNA, it becomes a, the newest iteration and the latest sort of, you know.
But you said Mexico is only one of them.
Right. That's the one that is the first to codify it as a law. Most others are policy statements. Even the law is very, it's very difficult to enforce. They will admit that, you know, in terms of the teeth that it has, it's very difficult. So other places have sort of policy statements, India and so on, that it's hard to regulate. But yeah.
What ultimately happened in Iceland? What ultimately happened in Iceland?
So maybe someone else knows. Does someone else know? I think they went. They almost went bankrupt.
They didn't get the funding.
No. Yeah.
What was the ultimate?
Yeah.
Combination of the three data.
I know a lot of people lost money. Okay. Yeah, they filed for bankruptcy, yeah. Right. Right, I see a hand back there.
Laurel.
Oh, Laurel? Uh-huh.
I just wanted a little bit more detail on the H3 story, which is intriguing. Mm-hmm. So you said that there was this big announcement in London.
Yes. At Reuters? Is that how you say it, Reuters? Say that again.
Sorry, it was in London.
Yeah. Right, no. No, but we have two Africans on our panel, and we have an African director, and, you know, if you look at the web, they're really adamant that, you know, they have all in their Q&A is that, you know, this will, if the samples leave Africa, that it's only temporary. It's only because we're still building our infrastructure, and we'll get it back. And there's constant sort of appeal to make sure that we are in control of this, and this is for us. And so, you know, it's in there. And I don't know the extent to which any clinic has opened yet, because this was like a few months ago. But I'm keeping track, so I'll let you know. So your question is, how does U.S. patent law in terms of genes, how does that travel, really? And I don't know. Does anyone in the room, any lawyers, patent lawyers?
Well, I think the person is referring to the suit by the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU,
the breast cancer, related to the breast cancer.
DRCA, mm-hmm. 1 and 2. And that has, of course, even to the surprise mm-hmm. of the ACLU,
they won.
they won the federal court case at that level. Mm-hmm. However, the ruling does not change currently mm-hmm. what is going on in American patent law until it's appealed. Mm-hmm. And of course, the biotech industry is right now preparing mm-hmm. Briefs on this as well mm-hmm. as the plaintiff groups. Mm-hmm. So the next level will determine mm-hmm. whether that's just going to be very focused mm-hmm. on one patent mm-hmm. or whether it's going to have a broad effect mm-hmm. on all the other human gene patents mm-hmm. that have been taken out.
And I think even when that is settled, I still will be keen to see how that affects this sort of multinational exploration of DNA. So if I think of the stem cell context, for example, often where the regulation tightens, that often leads to a push to go look for it elsewhere where it's less regulated and where patents are maybe more protected or maybe no one's looking. So I don't know, the extent to which it becomes stricter here, it may facilitate even greater sort of moves to...
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that you might find a nice comparative study by looking at what happened in agricultural breeding. Mm-hmm. So, in the international agricultural plant breeding institute all around the world, there would be these high-profile things like the dwarf. And so on, mm-hmm. but they would do a lot of work in human capacity building local plant breeders, mm-hmm. and they would pay attention to the varieties that work well in these regions. But in the 1980s, mm-hmm. with gene sequencing and molecular biology, mm-hmm. they all went molecular,
yeah.
or that became the dominant way.
Yeah.
So once you go molecular, you're not breeding diverse, you're breeding diverse. Each little region, you're
yeah.
trying to get the one that trumps everything
yeah.
somehow genes.
Yeah.
So exactly how that played out, whether the countries that allowed their research institutes to shift across to mm-hmm. the molecular approach ended up with, I haven't followed on it, ended up with their own critique of the way they mm-hmm. went, or whether it's been, mm-hmm. Whether the people who are doing this for human genomics mm-hmm. are just mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes me, what comes to mind is Corey Hayden's work, When Nature Goes Public. And so what's most interesting in that sort of rich multi-sided ethnography is really the way that different entities become represented, so that you can no longer undertake any of this without at least giving some nod to participatory science, participatory, whether it's in agriculture or genetics, but exactly, how that takes shape, who gets to stand in for who, how these sort of community gatekeepers. So, for example, in the Mexico case, 7 states were sampled. That's what comprises the representative sample for the country, but it just happens those the governors of those states were the ones who, because of different political relationships, allowed the researchers to come in, and governors that didn't have those relationships blocked the sampling. And so you see the way that sort of political processes sort of then begin to shape what becomes representative of the country. And so it's like that intermediary level, not the nation-state policies, which are interesting of themselves, and not necessarily just the clinic level, but the way that, that the politics of representation happens is something that I really... Sarah?
My question is about a different kind of representation. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy your talking. Mm-hmm. It's especially interesting to me to listen to someone who's sort of hanging out in a different mm-hmm. set of mm-hmm. public health sites.
Yes.
So one of the things that I really grappled with when I was in the field was trying to find the negative cases, mm-hmm. right? No.
Yeah.
The public health has never been this.
Yeah.
And I had to work really hard
to find
that. Ask people, can you give me the name of someone mm-hmm. who totally disagrees with you? Mm-hmm. Often they say someone that person would really disagree with mm-hmm. you, right? But I'm just curious if there's pushback, especially around this question mm-hmm. of what public health has been historically, mm-hmm. not just in the U.S., mm-hmm. right, but in these different states.
Yeah, so from what I know of my collaborator in Mexico City, it gives me sort of some glimpse into the fact that, okay, you create this new 11th health ministry, you're investing money, and almost certainly, you know, the researchers and people working in other health ministries, other universities, where the experience that money is leaving their areas are some of the primary opposite. It comes within the medical and scientific community opposing this new turn, right? So not even from the sort of activists, which you do have. You have people who are saying, you know, the issues of access and affordability, you have those voices. You had the major thing that all the newspapers and so on were really harping on was simple corruption. Like, you said you're going to build this building, and why is all the money going here? And, you know, those sorts of biomedical issues. And so you have a lot of those sorts of, you know, a lot of kinds of pushback like that. And so for me, figuring out, you know, how to track that is something that I'm thinking about, yeah. I'd like to talk to you about how you found your negative cases.
Yeah, I have. I really enjoyed your talk. Yeah. I wonder if you could elaborate a little on the concept of harmonization of social justice and the ways in which you're now using that.
Yeah.
You summed everything up.
Yeah. Sure. So, you know, maybe a closer to home case for many of you who may be familiar with the Beidel story is the fact that the NAACP, the Black Cardiologists Association, and a number of leading minority health activists were on board with Nitramed, with the company. There was sort of, you know, definitely a way in which they provided a sort of moral justification. This is for us, you know. And so it's that buy-in. Really, the idea that this investment in pharmaceuticals is, you know, a viable way of redressing health disparities. And so when I think of social justice here, I'm specifically thinking of health disparities, and that, you know, when people are including you, so Epstein talks about recruitmentology, and now we have to get samples from we have to include everyone fairly. That process of being included, so what is the underside of that? You know, and I think there are multiple ones, you know, that we could sort of come up with. But I think really the question there is, what's the underside of this inclusion? Is inclusion always good? You know, and, you know, both on the level of what kinds of categories you have to fall into and buy into to fit, you know. But also in terms of just materially, you know, is this where we want to invest our health concerns? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The biodiversity convention was really designed to address genetic colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Bioprospecting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that a company couldn't go, if they signed it, they couldn't go to a country, take a leaf, put it in their pocket, bring it home, genetically sequence the proteins in it, and decide they were going to produce something, and not give anything back to the country. Of course, the United States didn't sign it. But in this case, with human genes, you can't just take a leaf, obviously. But is it the case that American companies are putting money into Mexico for human genetics and not expecting some return on the genetic information? Is that the implications of what you were saying?
Not expecting? No, I think...
Not getting?
No, I would say that those collaborations are... They're thinking a few steps ahead. One, because they're losing ground here and they're looking for other markets. And so, but part of it is to collaborate benignly. Like, we're going to help, we're going to donate these, you know, these facilities and so on. And then with the, I would hypothesize with the expectation that as things become closer, you know, but closer to the clinic, they would be in already.
You know. What about that goal?
But I don't know. Genomic sovereignty. The what I was trying to say was that it ensures that you have to collaborate with national research. It doesn't say you cannot come in. It just says you have to go through us. You have to work with our researchers. We have to be in some way, you know, in control of the extent to which you're.
It's a little like the biodiversity.
I would say I have to learn more about that though. Mm-hmm.
I think it's implicit in what's been said so far, but maybe it's worth emphasizing that while there are conditions like HIV which need further research, in many cases, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, internal and DNA retaliate. No research, no investigation. Everybody understands what has to be done. We did not research, but action.
Mm-hmm.
And replacing action with research is her bad.
I agree with you.
Maybe on that note then, let's thank our speaker again.
Well, I'm going to back.